I'm John Kroll. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy's famous speech commemorating that event here in Indianapolis. Today on No Limits, we are going to talk about that important moment in the history of the city, state, and country. My guests are Indiana Representative Greg Porter, who is a board chair of the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative, the Honorable Theodore Bohm, who is a former justice of the Indiana Supreme Court, and the Reverend Thomas Brown, retired pastor of Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church and a civil rights worker. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or finding us on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy's famous speech commemorating Dr. King's murder here in Indianapolis at 17th and Broadway. We're going to focus today in No Limits on the importance of that moment in this city's, this state's, and this country's history with some people who experienced it from different points of view. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indiana Representative Greg Porter. He is a Democrat from Indianapolis. He's also the board chair of the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative. We are also joined by retired Indiana Supreme Court Justice Theodore Ted Bohm. He was a 29-year-old lawyer at the time. I guess I'm outing you in terms of your age these days as well, for people who can do math.
And matter of public record.
And Robert F. Kennedy campaign volunteer who was present at the speech, and the Reverend Thomas Brown, who's a retired pastor with Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church and civil rights worker. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So I want to start first, I think, with these, and I want to invite any of our listeners who were either alive at that time and remember that moment, particularly those who were present there in some way, to call in and share their memories. But I'd like to ask each of you, and I'm gonna start with the Reverend Brown to talk about your memories of that day, you know, 50 years and one day ago now.
I'll make it quick for you.
Sure.
At that day when Dr. King was assassinated, I was on the highway on my way to Memphis to the event. I had been working in Arkansas, Louisiana, and also getting young people into college. At that particular time, I had just ceased being part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee with SNCC, and at the same time had been doing some consulting work with the United Negro College Fund and, of course, SCLC. I did consulting work with them, which my role was to recruit young people to go into college, and I was heading up to Memphis, and I knew Dr. King was there. The connection was in regard to that event that night when they announced it in my car radio. I did a complete U-turn and headed back to Texas because I knew what the community situation was like. So I called my dad in Indianapolis at St. Andrew J. Brown, who and King and the family, we've been knowing each other and as a youngster.
Yeah, we've talked about this before.
Yeah, I mean, you know. And so my dad was like, everything is in disarray, and at the same time, the circumstances of Indianapolis was because he was there. And we talked probably about 7 hours after the event. I mean, he said everything is calm here. Well, after that, just about 3 days later, I headed to Indianapolis to do some follow-up on students and got a pretty good picture. I knew who the players were. So when it comes to me being there, like, my friend here, Representative Porter, they were here in the mix. Now, I heard all the stories, but I understand what was going on. The intensity was taking place in southern communities, and I really never thought it would happen in Indianapolis, because that's a dynamic that I could do a whole book on.
Mm-hmm. Justice Baum.
Well, I was working on the Kennedy campaign and was there in the field office they had set up in downtown Indianapolis when the word came in of Dr. King's death, and that the Kennedy campaign hadn't decided what to do about it. As I think you know, the mayor's office here didn't want the event to go forward. They thought it was too risky. But Senator
Richard Lugar at the time came and asked him not to go.
He was only a few months in office.
It was his birthday, too. That's the other thing. It was Lugar's birthday.
So my perspective of it was I was just there as somebody who was, from the campaign's perspective, trying to put an Indiana spin on all the speech appearances. So if Kennedy went to Michigan City, I'd feed the Don Larson from Michigan City, and he's the guy who pitched the no-hitter in the World Series in 47. That kind of stuff. I'd get stuff from lawyers around the state that I knew, or that I could knew somebody in my firm, knew somebody in almost every county seat town. So that was my role, but I had I was just an observer of the debate as to going on as to whether the event should go forward. And finally, the word came from the campaign that was still in flight that they wanted to go forward. So, okay, and my job was to go over and help set up the thing before the people came. And then more importantly, to see that the hotel, the Marat Hotel, where the reception afterwards was held, was properly set up. So I heard the speech, but I heard it from the back of the crowd, and my visual impression of the whole thing is I was standing in an empty field with a whole lot of people, and everybody was quiet, and I could hardly hear the senator's speech. Of course, I've heard it on tape many times since.
Do you remember the moment when you heard that Dr. King had been shot?
Well, of course, I knew it because I'd been in the campaign office, but I heard the moment that he announced it to the crowd, and there an audible gasp went up from the crowd and a few cries. I mean, you definitely knew that many people in the audience did not know it until Senator Kennedy told them.
Yeah, there are a lot of things about that era that, you know, that are hard to communicate today. The fact that news does not disseminate its way across the globe within the space of seconds, that there were times you actually had to wait to find things out and all of that. Representative Porter, your memories of that day.
Well, I remember that day from the perspective of being like 11, 12-year-old. And one of his places, I guess auxiliary campaigns, was on 34th Street. And I grew up at 34th and Kenwood. And right across there was, you know, one of his offices. And I remember going out prior to that, you know, talking about him and passing out flyers and, you know, welcoming people to the community, because I loved him because of his brother. You know, my grandparents, who I grew up with, were just, you know, we had his picture up, had JFK's picture up in the house, you know, so that's what I knew. But I can remember we got a call from some relatives, my grandmother did, down south, and told us what has happened, and she started, you know, weeping, and I'm going like, okay, wow, you know, 1968, you know, I think of the ball of confusion, I think of all these other things, but I realized that this was very, very significant, and what role would one play on that? And being at 34th in Kenwood, and the Marat being at Fall Creek, you know, it wasn't that far away. And we would walk and do things in the community. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it meant a lot. And it did change my whole perception about community and getting involved. And I was scared. I mean, as a young man, you know, I was afraid what would happen. And then we began to see things erupt around, you know, the community. Because And I just remember having family members that lived in Watts, and in what happened in Watts years prior to that. I began to, you know, begin to connect those two. Is it going to happen in Indianapolis?
And that's something that we are on No Limits today talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which happened yesterday, and the famous speech Robert F. Kennedy made here in Indianapolis marking the event. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Representative Porter, I want to stay with you, but I want everyone's thoughts on this. The other thing I think that is difficult to communicate to people who were not alive at that time, and I was just a year or two younger than you are at that time. I'm sorry to rub it in this way, but
that's okay. But we both don't have much hair.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, my grandfather would have said, who was himself follically challenged, you know, grass doesn't grow on a busy street. So
no, I take that.
So one of the things that that is difficult to communicate is how fractured the country was at that time. I mean, I was a child. I think I was just finishing the third grade when this happened, and my parents would have me watch the news at night, and you'd see the body counts from Vietnam. We had riots, civil disturbances all over the country. To my young eyes at the time, it seemed like the country was just coming apart. And so you kind of have to understand that, I think, to get what a hammer blow this was to people, to understand what the stakes were going into that, to that speech. Could you speak a little bit to that point and what it was like to be alive and young at that moment?
Well, you know, I was reflecting on that not too long ago. In 1967, 68, 69 was kind of turbulent times from my perspective, and it very impressionable to me. I mean, there were some good things, but the only thing we kept hearing night after night was about the Vietnam War. We kept hearing about civil rights, social justice, and, you know, dealing with our community. And then, you know, from a black perspective, you know, because we're, you know, black and proud, you know, we had 1968, you know, when the Olympics, when Tommy Lee Smith and John Carlos raised their hand, you know, that was something powerful. And then we had songs during that era of Ball of Confusion, and then people's songs, What's Going On. And if you look at those lyrics, being a young man, though, they were very impressionable upon me, because I'm listening to the music like kids listen to music today, but you know, at
with
that time,
a transistor radio,
with transistor radio, you know, by big box, and I could understand what they were saying.
Yeah.
Now I can't. Yeah. My ears, my tympanic membranes just don't pick up on that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But we knew the United States was somewhere where people didn't want them to be. Even in the schools, through teachers or, you know, through sport or whatever. And then we saw people not, you know, as they called it back that time, you guys are acting out, you know. But I don't think people were acting out. I think they were looking for the greater good, and letting their thoughts and processes be known across this country and this world. So it was confusing. As I said, you know, we were very afraid, but we knew something was going on, but we just didn't have a big handle with it because we didn't know what was really going on in other parts of the country until the nightly news came on versus now. You know, now everything is too sweet right away, but we didn't have that. We had things that, as I would say, marinated or built up in regards to what was happening in various communities.
Justice Bohm, you were a young professional at that point.
Well, I think people my age were very aware that the country, in our perception, was coming apart. By that, I mean, of course, there is a wide division of opinion at that time still as to whether the Vietnam War should or shouldn't be being prosecuted. Mm-hmm. But those of us working in the Kennedy campaign generally felt, it was a military disaster, but more importantly, it was destroying the fabric of the country and creating a division that was going to be very hard to overcome, but that Bobby Kennedy presented a hope to correct this. And I still believe that would have been true if he'd lived. We can get into that later. Mm-hmm.
We are talking, and we're going to give the Reverend Brown a chance to respond after we come back for a break. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy's famous speech here in Indianapolis on that date. My guests are the Indiana Representative Greg Porter. He is the board chair for the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative, former Indiana Supreme Court Justice Theodore Ted Boehm, and the Reverend Thomas Brown, who is a retired pastor and civil rights worker. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy's famous speech here in Indianapolis on that date. My guests are Indiana Representative Greg Porter. He is a Democrat from Indianapolis who is also the board chair of the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative. Former Indiana Supreme Court Justice Theodore Ted Boehm, who was a 29-year-old lawyer and Robert F. Kennedy campaign volunteer and was present at the speech, and the Reverend Thomas Brown, who is a civil rights worker and is also the retired pastor of Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So before we went to the break, Reverend Brown, I'd asked everybody about this, sort of the mood of the country that we have to get. Got Representative Porter's thoughts and Justice Boehm's. I'd like to get yours as well.
Okay. I think... I'm sitting here listening to Representative Porter. You know, they were young, and glad to get a chance to meet the Supreme Court judge for the state of Indiana. So I'd like to introduce you on my show. But the dynamics was, for me in this whole thing, and is the fact I came up through the civil rights movement of the late 50s and the 60s. One of the most, I don't know if Greg can remember it, but one of the most terrifying things took place when Kennedy got killed within the black community, within the black experience. The Kennedy assassination rocked within the black experience, particularly in this area. I was in Mississippi at that time, traveling. Then the second dynamic that took place in the city of Indianapolis, and this is to give Indianapolis some credit. Registration and voter registration was intensifying. 63, 64, 65, 66, the African-American community was heavy getting people registered to vote. While I'm down in Selma and those places, people could not vote. And I was trying to recruit some people to come to work, work down in Alabama, and they thought I'd lost my mind. Now, I say all of that to build up to the fact that when Martin got killed, there was a spirit, not of calmness, but a great spirit of disappointment, because still people were coming out of that. And see, Bobby Kennedy was coming, and I think Mr. Porter knows many in the black community were excited.
Right.
Bobby Kennedy was going to win presidency.
And
if, you know, I'm trying to look back, but...
Yeah, the evidence was a little more iffy.
Right.
But yeah,
When Kennedy gets up before that crowd and has to announce about Martin, see, I knew Martin had got shot probably about 20 minutes after that. I'm saying, oh, I hope to the hell he's not dead. Maybe just hit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you over there, I'm almost in Memphis. And I'm seeing the intensity of the state troopers from Arkansas and Tennessee and Mississippi. You got to understand that's a if you travel as much as I had. And I said, oh, I think I better get out of here. Well, by the time you all hear here, well, he's dead. They already moving him at that point. So my position was Indianapolis was so shocked psychologically there could not emerge that there was an anger, but it was a, what I call an actively calm and calmly active anger that the people here did not have what I knew was getting ready to break, particularly New Orleans, particularly in Dallas, particularly in Houston, particularly in Jackson. We knew what was going on because we had a connecting link. Even I talked with Julian and John Lewis, and we in our different venues were aware. Stokely, we said, okay, it's time to get it going on. If we follow after that, you'll get another picture. But back to your initial question, was Indianapolis had been so progressive in its own political voters registration. My dad and Luger were very tight. And, of course, he had just come aboard, young, coming out of education. And
School board, and he'd had a partnership with an African-American school board member to feed hungry children. And I think, if I remember right, in the 71 mayoral race, he ended up getting 60% of the black vote, which was not common for Republican candidates.
No, it was not. And not for my dad, a Baptist preacher, that related to the Republican experience. But at that particular time, the politics of politics was not as so party-driven as it was driven on who's going to be the best individual.
Because I think this is you're hitting on an important point here, and I think it's one Justice Bohm and Representative Porter also alluded to, that it really is not just the fractured nature of the country, but even the fractured nature of how to respond to it. I know you were working for SNCC and SCLC. Mm-hmm. Often they were not seeing eye to eye at that time.
That's an interesting story, of course.
And that was a challenge for Dr. King at the end of his life, is trying to get everybody to march in the same direction.
But do you know what the real deal was? Because I was there when he came to Alabama, when we were sitting in those meetings, and he was always very calm. And he would say, "How you doing, Brown? Talk to your mother." My mother disliked me for going into the movement, but she always called him to find out how I was doing. But here's what happened in regard to how the media painted that picture. SNCC, SCLC, CORE, we always had a good working relationship. The dynamics was when King would show up, the media would follow him. And then the orders and the dictations given, if John Lewis, Stokely, all of us would say, "Here's what we need to do. We've been here." But the minute SCLC show up, the media would come in and we get caught into that. So they would catch us bickering because we're saying, "This is not the time. Let us get organized." Well, King would say, and he wasn't, it was more his associates. I knew Bevel, I knew Andrew, I knew James Orange, I knew all of them. And they would say, "No, this is what we do." And Dr. King would say, "Okay, this is the time to march." Hell, I've been in Selma from 1962. We were being there, and as soon as they show up, they would do a great event that night, and guess who go to jail next day? Us. Guess who get beat up? Us. So that was the friction. And it was not that heavy issue about nonviolence, though the media, when Stokely hit the black power thing, and you know, everybody said, "Oh, they're clashing." It was not really that much of a clash. It was over. We were being played and duped by the media when Dr. King would show up.
So let me, Justice Bohm, because I think that also speaks to kind of the hunger for, you know, even though in some ways he is presented as a divisive figure in American history, Robert F. Kennedy also, for a lot of people, was seen at that time as one of the last great hopes for the country to heal itself, that he was perhaps the one figure who could pull things together. What was it about him that made him such a powerful force in that fashion?
I think an awful lot of it was simply being John Kennedy's brother. But he played it very well. I mean, he really was a talented guy. And witness the speech that he came up with on the night of Dr. King's assassination. I mean, that was Robert Kennedy wrote that. That wasn't Ted Sorensen. That wasn't some very slick writer coming up
or
with
Jeff
a lot
Greenfield
of good
Greenfield or any of the other folks. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of substance to Robert Kennedy. But I do think he had one ace in the hole that nobody else had, and that is he was John Kennedy's brother. And certainly at that time, there was an enormous sense of loss across America, mm-hmm. white and black together on that point. Probably the African-American community felt it even more because of his role in all that he, to some extent, was drag kicking and screaming into it. But he did ultimately hold out a hope for getting the Civil Rights Act, and you got to credit Lyndon Johnson with getting that done. But by 1968, Lyndon Johnson's political capital had been spent in the Vietnam War.
So let me ask this, because you were of age at that time. Why did you line up with Robert Kennedy as opposed to Eugene McCarthy? Because there were two anti-war candidates at that time, which is, and I'm asking the question because that was a huge fault line in American life at that moment as well. I'm trying to get at how high the stakes were at this
moment. Some of my colleagues on the court accused me of being a pragmatist. I guess that's fair in a way. The short answer is I thought Robert Kennedy clearly was the fellow who could win the presidency, and I didn't think Gene McCarthy could. That Hubert Humphrey quite highly of Hubert Humphrey generally, but he had so much baggage from the war that it'd be impossible for him to overcome that. And Bobby Kennedy could bring enough of a Democratic coalition together to carry the White House. And if he had, we'd have a completely different country today. The war wouldn't have gone on as it did. We wouldn't have had Watergate. We wouldn't have had all sorts of events wouldn't have happened that have dramatically changed the character of American society.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named James, and if you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can track us down on Twitter @WFYI, or you can do what James did, reach out to us on Facebook and find us at nolimits@WFYI. James writes, I've lived in Indiana my entire life and am 34 years old. Last year was the first time I'd heard of the Robert Kennedy speech in Indianapolis. Sometimes I feel like there's a disconnect between residents of Indiana and events of historical significance. In the panel's opinion, what is something that people can do to learn more about events like this? I think that one's queued up for the chair of the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative.
Nice cue.
Right into his wellhouse.
Thank you. Well, and James, thank you for raising that question. I'm going to give a little bit of history. We, as an organization, as KKMI, is a young organization, 501c3, but the movement started over 25 years ago or so. Through Representative Bill Crawford and a gentleman by the name of Larry Conrad. And Larry, what Bill had told me, went over to the park and said, this is significant, what happened that night with Bobby Kennedy. And we can't let this go undetected and talked about. So years ago, we started working, and Bill at that point, being a member of the General Assembly, had a particular platform, was not only being involved with SCLC or in the movement here, but was a member of the General Assembly, and through that said the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus was going to help move this forward. Mm-hmm. And so that's when we start working and having programs on April 4th. And then it evolved years later to June 6th, and that's another part that we may want to talk about in the future. But you know, we had been out there for a while talking about this. Everybody kind of knows April 4th. We have a core individuals that come out. And every year, it's gotten larger. First few years, you might have had 100, 150 people, didn't have a tent. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, even yesterday, we still had 800 or 900 people, and it was freezing out there.
Yeah.
So But you know, we're on Facebook now. We're talking about it. We tweet and things. So we're trying to move more into the millennium's lives. But I think, and we have things in the Indianapolis Recorder, and the Stars ran, and the other papers have read things. I have read things about what was going on. So you're right. There's sometimes, I mean, we don't, more people outside Indiana knows about Kennedy King Memorial Initiative, yeah, or the Peace Memorial than some people within the city, because, or within the neighborhood.
Because, like, if you go to the Kennedy Library in the Boston area, that speech is in a perpetual loop.
I mean, right.
No matter when you walk by, they're showing RFK's speech, and it's an incredibly moving moving experience to see it. We talk, and I want to get this, the fact that this spot really wasn't marked for so many years. I mean, I remember long ago when I was a newspaper reporter, Jerry Bruno, who was the advance guy for the Kennedy campaign, came back here for something, and they sent me out to interview him, and I talked with him. At the end of it, he said, you know, I think he had remarried at that point, and he wanted to show his new wife where the spot was where Robert Kennedy made that speech. And I had to tell him in that point, in, you know, in terms of geographic sort of landmarks, that there wasn't actually a place that he could go. Why did it, and I'm going to ask Justice Bohm this, why do you think it took us so long to realize the significance of that spot and that moment?
I think several things. Part of it had to do with the tumult that was throughout this period. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just one thing after another. I mean, first, we had the war escalating, all these terrible events of 1968, which and then on into the 70s. Immediately, we got, you know, students at Kent State being killed, and these national events keep piling on us. In some respects, it was
found
just like the tweets of today.
It
was just every day there's something else crowded, what happened yesterday, off the news. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for the perspective of history to realize that this was really a seminal point in a very important event, namely the Kennedy March to the White House, that while it wasn't anywhere near as important as what happened in California 2 months later, it certainly was a significant step forward that showed Kennedy could win in a Midwestern state with a broadly Republican bent. And that was a major step forward in the public perception of the success of that campaign. And on to California it went. And as you know, he won the California primary. But then one after another, you had the riots at the convention, and one thing after another drowned out everybody's attention. And I think it took the perspective of history to really see that something very important happened here in April of 1968.
Reverend Brown, how, we've only got about a minute left before we have to take a break. How important is it, though, that spot is marked now?
It's very important, and I understand how you struggle with why it didn't happen, and it's timing. Think about the timing. Right there in 1968, over there on 17th and College, that was the hood.
That was the hood.
I mean, and like you, I had to laugh at the judge at his age. I was right behind you at the same age. I wasn't going to Vietnam. And see, we still had the draft going on. You got to remember the dynamic of running from the draft.
Mm-hmm. We are talking, even at our age, you start, kids that age were thinking about, what am I going to do if my number comes up? We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy's famous speech commemorating that moment, which took place here in Indianapolis at roughly 17th and Broadway. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Greg Porter, former retired Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Theodore Bohm, and the Reverend Thomas Brown. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which was yesterday, and the famous speech that Robert F. Kennedy made here in Indianapolis that evening at 17th and Broadway. My guests are Indiana Representative Greg Porter. He's a Democrat from Indianapolis who's also the board chair of the Kennedy King Memorial Initiative, former Indiana Supreme Court Justice. I'm sorry, I promoted him as we went into the break last time. Theodore Boehm, who at the time was a 29-year-old lawyer and a Robert F. Kennedy campaign volunteer and witnessed the speech. And the Reverend Thomas Brown, who was a civil rights worker and is retired pastor of Ebenezer Missionary Baptist Church. So we've gotten an email from a listener named Sean, and if you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or do what Sean did, send us an email at nolimits@WFYI.org. Sean writes, in 1998, on the 30th year commemorative of that day, President Clinton, Senator Ted Kennedy, Andy Jacobs, and Billy Breaux were here, and I got to meet them all. Because I am in a wheelchair and visually impaired, the Secret Service got me right up front. The protesters, all eight of them, weren't moved to a free speech zone two blocks away, as they always have been the few times a Republican president has been there. It was a great day for a sad occasion. That was one of the moments, though, Representative Porter, that sort of got Indianapolis to realize that this is an important place in American history.
Right, it was. And I can remember, matter of fact, it was raining that day also. Mm-hmm. I was there along probably...
Not good weather days here for these
No, well, you know, it is. I can remember that day. I mean, I was talking to it the other day about with some other individuals when the president came here and Evan Bayh was the governor. And that kind of like gave it another shot in the arm. Like, this is what happened here. Mm-hmm. And it rekindled some thought processes. And it was another momentum that happened here in the city, along with the people in that community. And even at that time, that park was still going through some transition. Mm-hmm. And see, Dr. Brown kind of talked about it. You know, it wasn't the greatest neighborhood. It was in transition. The people were great. Citizens Multi-Service Center was there. We were providing services. You had Citizens Health Center was there. I mean, you had the amenities of a community, but it was still going through a transition. And when the president came there and said, this is a great place. This is what we need to have. This is what we need to do here. It began to pick up the enthusiasm, and people began to reconnect to that spot and to that community.
And that was that the spur for the creation of the sculpture that is there that
yes.
marks it now, that was the inspiration. I've got to give a shout out to the guy,
Greg Perry.
Greg, who was I went to high school with Greg. He's yes. The late Greg Perry. He was a wonderful guy. So that was the inspiration for creating and commemorating that place.
Yes, sir. That was it. And Greg Perry, along with other people, that was a small group of individuals. You know, these people have gone on. You know, Julia Carson, Mark St. John, Greg Perry, Larry Conrad. They all, you know, well, particularly Larry told Bill that not to let this die. And then Representative Crawford and others began to just kind of march on and create this atmosphere of a peace with Martin Luther King and Robert Francis Kennedy reaching out to each other. And I mean, that was incredible. It is incredible.
We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy's famous speech here in Indianapolis on that night. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Susan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Susan, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, no, please.
Oh, well, I was at this at that speech that Kennedy gave in 68, and it's, well, I think it would impress anybody and influence them who heard it. But my question is, when Robert Kennedy entered, he was really kind of stepping on Eugene McCarthy, who I supported and worked for in Indiana. And I'm just wondering why he waited. You know, why didn't Kennedy get in earlier?
I think, sadly, probably the only person who can answer that definitively is Robert F. Kennedy, and he's not with us anymore. But I'll ask Justice Bohm for his thoughts. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pure speculation, but I think part of it was there was real doubt in 1966 or 67 that anybody could defeat Lyndon Johnson for re-election. So why get into it? I mean, he's a successful senator from New York. And
they thought he was going to win in 72 if he waited. So
yeah, exactly.
And he was only 42 at the time. I mean, the other thing that strikes me when I see all of this stuff now is how young these guys were. I mean, Martin Luther King was only 39 when he was killed. RFK was only 42.
Can you imagine at my house when I'm 14?
Yeah.
See, King, Abernathy, and them visit us in the 50s during the Civil Rights. They were young. I got to listen to King at the age of 24. My dad at that time was 31. And all of the guys that came through that, the guys and other people of notoriety of the movement of 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, these are young guys and young ladies. And their conversation was a whole nother. Was in a whole nother dimension. And like we were just saying, Bobby and what was taking place, these were young persons. These were what you would say now in the 21st century. They were almost like a millennial.
Yeah. Right. Well, and they were...
To the structure.
And at that point, age was considered youth was considered kind of a barrier to that. I mean, it had been a big issue when John Kennedy ran. Now we're kind of using, you know, Bill Clinton, I think, was 46, and Barack Obama was 47 when they were... When they were elected, we're kind of used to seeing, you know,
right,
people who are early in middle age assume positions of great responsibility. But that was something pretty new at that point, right, Justice Bohm?
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with that, that it was a combination of all these things. And it was just, it looked like a pretty tough task viewed from 66 or so when Gene McCarthy started.
And there's no other way, I think, to put it. And to say it other than the fact also that LBJ and RFK hated each other. There was absolutely no love lost there at all.
That's true to every account I've ever read.
Right, yeah. And I think there was a on Tuesday night we had a viewing at the Indiana Historical Society, Ripple of Hope. Mm-hmm. And that it was a piece in there that talked about why he got in what he did. Mm-hmm. I think someone decided not to run because of the Vietnam War, because it was just that tough. And I guess if they had polls at that time, I guess the consensus was that this is not good. And so I think he got in during that time of it. But the Ripple Hope really has a nice piece in regards to why Bobby got in when he did.
Well, and I'd always heard, too, in research that Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy didn't have a whole lot of respect for each other either. It wasn't the level of animosity that RFK and LBJ had, but that, you know, because I think I had heard somewhere that Bobby Kennedy had said he would have supported McGovern if McGovern had gotten in at that point, but he couldn't do it with McCarthy. We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and the famous speech that Robert Kennedy made here in Indianapolis on that date. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what DeCarlos has done and reach out to us via Facebook. Find us at No Limits WFYI. DeCarlos writes, is there any truth to the rumors I heard about a threat from law enforcement that discouraged any riots here in Indianapolis? I suspect you'd be the one closest to the ground on that, Reverend Brown.
And the way you said it and then pointed, the there was a respect and at the same time a disrespect for law enforcement in the city of Indianapolis, which, you know, is a continuum across our country.
Yeah. Even today.
Across the country today. And this was the in the black community. When you look at right there at 17th, if y'all say 17th and Broadway, I'm saying 17th and College, that's our territory. Most of the people that live there went to high school. Well, I was older then, but the high school, they either went to Tech or Attucks, or they went to School 26, School 27, and it was an intense area. Yes, there was a fear of the police in the sense, hey, stay in your turf, act right, and be right and do right, because we'll take you out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's prevalent in certain parts of our community here. And the fear goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something when you said that, because I can remember my family talking about people allegedly, and because I wasn't there, coming from outside to Indianapolis to cause riots or to stoke the fire. And then I understand that there were people going in the crowd was saying, not now, not now.
Yeah.
And it was just, okay, let's figure this out. Mm-hmm. You know, let's not just totally react. And plus, you had some foot soldiers out there. There was in the neighborhood that was very close to at that time Luger, and
they took a bunch of the boys to another center and had them to play basketball to get it out of them. Mm-hmm. Now that goes back to my old buddies Reggie Jones, John Lance, and all of them who could have stirred something. But see, that wasn't the spirit to tear up your own stuff, because that was in our community.
Right.
Now, if you check the background of what we did in Detroit or what we did in those, we destroyed properties. They just wasn't going to do that.
We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy's speech on that date. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Bradley has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bradley, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I wanted to give an example of how the good effect that the speech and the peacefulness had in Muncie, Indiana, that night and afterwards. Robert Kennedy was speaking at Ball State before he took the flight to Indianapolis, and they stopped outside our house, which was right across the street from campus, and put the top down, and he and Ethel got on the back of the car, and they went down, and I took a shortcut and got to the men's gym and got to shake his hand and hear his speech. And so I came home very excited about him and his candidacy. And then after the shooting, we were worried about what might happen. And we had a black minister in Muncie, Reverend Williams, at Trinity Methodist Church, and our minister, Reverend Critchfield, at College Avenue Methodist Church, which was connected to the university. And they got together and said, we need to get our kids together to talk. And for the next 2 years, especially for the first year, we would meet once a week at our church, or Trinity Church. We would do things in the community together. We started a youth center, got an old building painted, and for a long time it helped keep the peace. And whenever they talk about this speech, they always talk about the lack of problems that there were compared to other cities. And this is an example of how the kids were able to talk to us more about Dr. King and about his idea of peace, and we were able to listen to Kennedy's speeches and get the idea that there didn't have to be the trouble. I do remember the anger that came from the black kids when they were talking, and it was like, hey, I'm on your side, you know, I'm white, I'm on your side, but But in listening to the ministers speak, that they would say, now look, this is getting out anger. It's not directed at you. It's directed at the white community in general. But because of that, we were able to have a couple of years of really community focus and focus on communication, not just no trouble, but communication between the races. And I've always been proud of the fact that the community on the east side with Trinity Methodist Church and Reverend Williams, that he was able to reach out to us and say, please come and talk so that we can avoid trouble.
Thank you very much for the call. Thanks very much, Bradley, and for sharing your story. Bye-bye. So I want to, picking up on the spirit of that, and we've alluded to this, you know, this was the first of a couple of sad dates that that came. We're coming to the close of the show here, and I'm going to start with Justice Bohm on this and give each of you about 30 seconds to deal with what we lost, you know, when we lost these two men in the space of 2 months' time, people that a lot of people look to for hope.
Well, I do think that the thing we lost immediately was the leader we needed to start us out of the tailspin we were in nationally, and that for a lot of reasons that were really beyond his control, Hubert Humphrey wasn't able to do that. And that we, as I said earlier, we would have a much different America today if we had not pressed the war on for another 7 years, and all the divisions that that created, and all the mistrust of government in general, and to some extent, where he's still living now with a sort of a kickback where many people think the media is corrupt. I don't believe that for a minute. The general national media are, but there, a lot of people hold that opinion today, and it's fortified by the environment that we got ourselves into that I think there's a decent chance we wouldn't be in had we taken a different turn in 1968. It was a pivotal year.
Representative Porter, 30 seconds.
What we lost were two incredible individuals who really, I feel, from my perspective, understood the fabric of America, what America was up to, where we were, and where we need to go. Both of them leading their love and understanding and looking for peace and togetherness to address the disparities of individuals. And to look toward that and make things happen for economics, the jobs, the education, the same things we're fighting for and advocating for today, they were there.
Reverend Brown, you've actually only got about 15 seconds.
I don't think we had a loss. I think we have had a lot to gain. We have grown as a people in the consciousness. We got to overcome the fear to love and the love to fear. They already said they were going to die.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests and our listeners for what has been a lively and provocative conversation. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator Scott McAllister. Technical producers Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations. We'll be right back.